There's only one insurmountable barrier so far that I'm aware of, and it's death. The others are manageable. As long as you don't give up, you know, I think you can always hope to find a way to solve problems. So, and I really believe that. And I love it when we encounter something in our business where we say, gosh, you know, there are only two models. There's this scaled model where everything's really big. There's this, you know, completely fragmented model where everything's really small and there's no in between. And it can't be in between because you've got to be either low cost or super different. And I love when I hear those things because it makes me want to do something different. You know, I love to find a new way. And I think there's always a way to do something, try something and experiment. You know, I just very rarely hit these real dark periods of doubt. I would much rather just act on something and then correct it later than sit around and doubt myself, worry about it too much.
This week, I'm excited to welcome Bracken Darrell, CEO of Logitech. In the short of the normal episode, industry-leading difference maker and masterful storyteller Bracken shares his perspectives on life, leadership, learning, the power and value of design thinking, Logitech's sustainability imperative, remaining nimble and fostering values of hunger and humility. Well, Bracken was born in Owensboro, Kentucky. He majored in English in Arkansas, then graduated accountancy in Texas. He became a public accountant to Arthur Andersen before earning his MBA at Harvard. This led him to pivot into brand management at P&G before finally moving into general management at GE, which set him on his path to becoming CEO at Logitech in 2012. What on paper looks like a stellar linear journey, in reality, Bracken has had to navigate and overcome imposter syndrome. While intentional with his goals, he's taken action, learned from mistakes, acknowledged successes, while remaining humble and focused on the journey ahead. It's pretty much a recipe for engineering serendipity. Under Bracken's leadership, Logitech's experienced significant growth. After a decade of leading innovation, digital transformation, and fostering a design-led culture at Logitech, Bracken is now focused on transforming forward and scaling Logitech's impact beyond mere profit for the benefit of people and the planet. Okay. Welcome to the Impossible Network, Bracken. It's great to speak to you.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Thanks a lot for having me, Mark.
Well, I very much appreciate your time on this Friday afternoon. And where does this find you?
I am in California, Northern California, which for once in a lately it's been very rainy, but today it's beautiful.
I was going to say, I'm sitting here in Austin, Texas, and we had the most torrential storm last night, but sunny today. So everyone's happy.
We're in good places.
So having established with my introduction as to what you do, I'd love to start with two fundamental, pretty big questions, really about you, for people that don't know you, just to establish who you are. So the question is, who are you? Who are you as a human being?
Well, I'm a father of three. I'm a friend to many, and I'm a person who loves to try to make an impact on the world through the things I love, and I love a lot of things. One of them is my work.
So you are doing extraordinary things in your role currently as a CEO of Logitech. You clearly must have very solid values and principles. Who made you or what made you the person you are today?
Well, I grew up in a small town in Kentucky, Owensboro. I had a single mom who my dad left when I was nine or 10 years old. And that probably made me quite independent. And then a whole bunch of things probably impacted me, including my siblings. But one of the things that happened in that year when my dad left was my mom kind of fell apart. And she had probably a nervous breakdown and had four car wrecks in 1 year. She would come home every night and second guess what she'd done in school that day. She was a first grade teacher and, you know, what she said to the principal and her marriage, you know, that was over. And at some point in those conversations I had with her, and I imagine my siblings had them too, I don't know. I said to her, you know, Mom, it's everything that's already happened, you obviously can't change. So you should just imagine you're standing on a beach, you've got a stick in your hand and you drag that stick behind your heels. Everything behind you is just to learn from. It really, you can't change it. So you should just learn from it. And then your whole life is right here. And, that's one of those fundamental tenets I've grown up with. Not just don't try to look back in the past and relive it, but also this idea of continuously starting with that line in the sand behind you. You know, it's a chance to start over again every year, every month, you know, and I think, you know, really having that mindset of being a beginner all the time it reinforces a need that, not the need, but just the reality that you ought to be humble. You are not your failures, and you are not your successes. You know, you're whatever you're going to be from here forward.
It's quite a stoic mindset.
I do like stoicism, as a matter of fact.
It's interesting.
Marcus Aurelius.
Yeah.
For anybody listening out there, if you're looking for an amazing book that most people have not read, there's a book that the writer, I'm convinced, read Memoirs of Marcus Aurelius' Meditations, and then created a fictional autobiography by the famous Emperor Hadrian, who selected Marcus Aurelius, his emperor too, after him. And it's called Memoirs of Hadrian, and it's amazing, written by Margaret Yersinar.
I didn't know that. I will add that to show notes and put it on my Audible list.
It's an incredible book.
Okay, that's a good one. And who was the author?
Margaret Yersinar, who is she's Belgian by birth, but grew up in France. Won the equivalent of the Pulitzer Nobel for France.
Excellent. Okay. Well, that's a great one. I'll definitely add that. So you mentioned your mother and the impact of your mother. Were there any other sort of teachers, mentors, or early life experiences that were pivotal or defining in the journey you've taken?
Yeah, you know, I guess I couldn't go a step further without talking about my siblings, you know, Bobby, Bart, and Shelley. So two older brothers and a younger sister. And I think, you know, if birth order has a lot to do with you, I think who happens to be in that birth order also has a lot to do with who you are. I am blessed with three great people in those roles. And each one of them played a different role in my life, you know. And the coolest thing about that is in the early days, they helped me be more competitive, face reality a lot, you know, and be kind. And then most recently, now they're really good friends, and we support each other. You know, we have a, like so many families do, we have an ongoing chat going. So these are lifelong loves that have really been amazing.
Well, let's talk about what you're working to achieve before you leave this mortal coil, as was in Hamlet's famous soliloquy. You've a long way to go yet, a lot of work to do. And we are living at a time, at a very pivotal point in time. And I was talking to a guest the other day, Melanie van der Velde, and she talked about Adam Smith's theory of moral sentiments and said that free markets can only operate with strong principles of justice. Now, I listened to you, a great reflection on your 10 years at Logitech, and you talked about transforming forward with a clear mission to address the social, organizational, and environmental injustices that exist. And at your recent Edison Achievement Award, you talked about enabling people to fulfill their passions in a way that is good for the planet. Now, many people today clearly feel anxious. Now, the guests have recently talked about this great unraveling that's happened after COVID, that there's almost a societal level trauma going on. And many people feel hopeless about the scale of the challenges we feel and expect that governments are failing us. But you're an industry-leading CEO visionary, and you're leading this transformation forward. Can you explain why business leaders like yourself can be difference makers over governments and be the standard bearers for change that we need in the world?
Yeah, maybe I'll tell a story to try to explain that, my view of that. When George Floyd was murdered in 2020, the most notable thing in the first few days after it had hit the internet and, you know, hundreds of millions of people saw it, was the silence coming from the top of government. And you know, that was a very uncomfortable silence, and I think took me by surprise. I think took a lot of us by surprise. I think most of my life as a leader, I've been used to the government taking, you know, a moral stand on things that seem to matter. And there didn't seem to be anybody taking a moral stand at the very top. And so that caused me to reflect on, you know, on my past. I was thinking about South Africa and apartheid. And I was at my dining room table kitchen table about 4 days later. And I was thinking about, wonder what those business leaders in South Africa, when this was going on, I'm sure there were a lot of great moral business leaders living and working in apartheid who disagreed with apartheid. I was thinking, wonder what they did. I wonder if they spoke out. And then it kind of struck me, like getting hit in the head with a baseball bat or something, that I'm one of those leaders and I'm living in American apartheid and I'm not speaking out. And that was a dramatic kind of transformative moment in my mindset where I realized I'd always thought I was one of the good guys. I realized that I was just one of the guys and it was time to completely flip that upside down. And I really stunned to look in the mirror, see what I really was, which was a bystander. And so I drafted my first, blog post on LinkedIn on the George Floyd murder. And I proceeded to kind of turn my whole life over, all the rocks in my life and look on the other side and see what I'd been missing and real focus on trying to understand, how in the world I was sitting in the middle of having black friends and, thinking I was an advocate for anti-racism and that I just sat there and said nothing for so long. And I realized I'd done very little relative to what I thought, even though I was on the diversity council and I was all these things. So that was a dramatic moment for me. And I think to answer your question now more directly with that background, I think I realized that actually we can't leave it up to governments to do the right thing. We're in a world where companies are global and companies have incredible resources and influence on their own people and on the people around them and their customers and suppliers. And you can make a massive difference. The reason I got into this business is because you can make a massive difference from an individual company. So why in the world wouldn't you do that in places where justice really is not happening? And then I can answer your follow-up question, which I'll ask for you, which is it the role of the company to have a moral position? And is it your job to try to seek justice in these jobs, or is it your primary job to seek value creation for shareholders and let society deal with the rest? I think the really exciting thing about that question is that I don't think you can separate at least two areas of two moral areas from business performance anymore. I think for certainly environmental sustainability, I think if you're not an environmentally sustainable company in the next decade, you'll be out in almost every industry. At least you'll be behind and losing ground. And I think on DE&I will be the same. When I was an early CEO, I would go around to investor meetings with a virtual picture of a chart that showed the power of design to transform a company's value. And it showed design companies on one line and it showed all the other companies, the Dow Jones Industrial Average on the other. And design companies got a 300% better return over 10 years than non-design companies or everybody else. And I think we could put the same chart up 10 years from now. Those that are leading the way in environmental sustainability and DE&I will way outperform the others. And that's a leap of faith. It was a leap of faith for me on design a long time ago, but I was right then and I'll be right now.
Mm-hmm. What can be done to encourage other leaders to follow in your footsteps and accelerate the changes they're implementing? I mean, obviously there's a lot of conversation and talk at Davos and we've got ESG sort of standards. All investors are now focused on ESG. Stakeholder capitalism has talked about it at length, but still, if we actually look at, not talk about DE&I, but just looking at sustainability, there is a bit of a climate paradox. The things are moving at a certain speed, at a certain scale, but they're moving at the speed where we're actually seeing significant reductions in carbon emissions. We're still seeing widespread injustice, social and economic injustice. So if it is going to fall on the shoulders of organizations and their leaders like yourself to take these bold steps, some of them aren't moving fast enough, it would appear.
So I think, so your fundamental question, what could I do to influence other companies? What could Logitech do to influence other companies? I think, first of all, there are a lot of companies that are doing what we're doing. We're not as many as we need, but there are many, many joining the bandwagon here. We're carbon neutral now. We'll be climate positive or carbon negative by 2030. That's why in that purpose statement you mentioned earlier, I said we're going to be a company that enables all people to pursue their passions in a way that's good for the planet, not less bad. So we're going to be actually negative in carbon. part of our initiative there to impact not only our own company, but other companies, and put a forcing function on ourselves and others is to carbon label. So we started carbon labeling 3 years ago. Yeah. And we, and by carbon labeling and having an accurate carbon label, and then, you know, that's like calories, you know, if, you know, carbon's a new calorie. If you buy something and it has a label that has a carbon, a amount of carbon, you know, for example, this mouse is equal to about its entire life from the creation of the components to the end of life and usage in between, including the power in the wall. This is the equivalent of about a gallon of gas and carbon impact. If we're still a gallon of gas, you know, 3 years ago when we create the new version of that, we will have failed. And I suspect there will be advocates out there on the consumer side and the regulatory side who will think we failed. If our competitor is launching a product that's similar to this at 2 gallons of gas, they'll probably get dinged for that by Amazon and by everybody who rates them. So competition will be good, will be a really good thing for this, but we need carbon labeling. I'm a big proponent of legislation requiring carbon labeling on all products. It can be expensive, but the more of us who do it, the less expensive it will be. That's one thing we can do. The second thing we can do is be transparent about our goals and transparent about our data and make sure that we're all using the same kind of data. You know, just to use that example, you know, carbon labeling, you could have 1,000 different ways to come up with to estimate the amount of carbon in the life of any product. We need standards, and hopefully industries can join together and create the standards that are consistent. We're trying to do that, and we've got a lot of partners now behind the scenes that are advocates for that. But if not, we need to get it legislated, I think. And so for the first time in my career, I've got a legislative player on my team, because I do think this is super important. And that's just a couple of examples, but I think we're a little mouse company, but sometimes a little mouse can influence some big companies too.
Maybe, a growing mouse company.
Yeah. Maybe even a better way. Because we're Swiss, you know, so we're neutral to everybody, but we're able to kind of nudge people a little bit, not get in trouble.
You talk a lot about design thinking, and you've talked a lot about design being an iterative process aimed at imagining future state and then delivering it through new and existing technologies. Where do you think organization and leaders embracing your design thinking mentality can actually help them accelerate these solutions, leaving aside things like the carbon labeling? Because there's still a lot of talk around design thinking. It's a term that's thrown around quite without much thought, and I doubt whether many companies outside technology really do implement it. But I'm just wondering your perspective, given you're such a sort of a proponent.
Yeah, I think design and design thinking are not, it's not sort of a, here's what you do, and then you've completed it, and you're a design thinking organization, you know? I think it's a pathway to something much better for your users, and I believe for your shareholders and your employees and the planet. And there are three areas that you really have to think about when you're designing something for any individual user. The first is, what do they want? And often what you think you want, you don't really know what you want. You know, if I ask you what you want in a mouse, I'll take you a little while to come up with something. But I'll bet if I watched you and maybe gave you some things to do, and I'll bet I could figure out what you want even more than you could. So because I'm an expert in this business, in this product. So what is the desirability of the product? The second one is the viability of the product. Can you do it? Is there technology to push you out there to do that kind of thing? Can you do it at the cost you need to do that? And there are a couple more, but one of them that we've added is the environmental sustainability of the product. So is it good for the planet? Is it less bad than the prior version? Oh, we will get to less bad. So design for sustainability is part of design thinking now, and for good people really believe in design in its purest form. It started with Dieter Rams, who was a great industrial designer. One of his principles of design was design should be responsible to the planet. So I think design and design thinking can really be an incredible tool for any organization. And you don't have to start with a big design team, which I do have now. But when we started, we had nobody. And you can start small, but you can make a mighty impact. And everybody can be a design thinker, every single person, because at the end of the day, we're all experimenters. And that's the most important part of design thinking.
I heard you talk, obviously, before about the influence of Dieter Rams on your approach to leadership. And I also heard you talk about his 10 principles, but you've got five you talked about. And there's two of those principles. You maybe explain the five and then talk about two of them. You called, I think it's one's powerful idea, and the set number five is magical. Would you mind just unpacking that?
Yeah, one. So one powerful idea is, or one big idea, a big idea is one of them. So that's really, you know, finding a space that's really big to work on. You know, I always use Henry Ford's, you know, that everybody should have the freedom of a car, you know, the big idea, you know, and that there's another design principle, which is that what makes the Ford car different from, you know, the Volkswagen Beetle, you know, which is it has every great product should have a soul that expresses itself through every layer of experience. You know, the Beetle, you can picture what that is. It's for the Model T, it was the every man's car. Everybody has the same car. That was the idea. For the Volkswagen Beetle, it was a lovable buck. You know, it was a lovable thing. The magical part of that is really maybe in some ways the piece that people get right the least often, which is it should surprise you a little bit. Well, wonderful when you're surprised. You know, surprise is such an important component of experience. And if you're surprised, some people would say delighted, you don't want a bad surprise with the product or experience. But if you have a slightly surprisingly good experience, it's really amazing. And I just love when I have surprisingly good experience, whether it's a service experience or a physical product.
Talking of, you talk about mouse company, someone that works for a competitor to another mouse company, Pixar, Ed Catmull, is quoted as saying, when it comes to creative endeavors, the concept of zero failures is worse than useless. It's counterproductive. I've heard you talk a lot about your perspective on learning, failure through a learning lens. Can you share how you actually nurture that in your teams?
Yeah, I feel even stronger about that than Ed does. I actually don't think we should use the word failure or success. I think they're really dangerous concepts. I mean, everybody seeks success, but the minute you have it, you try to protect it and you lose a lot of the independence and experimentation that got you there. And then failure is, you know, terrible because you try to avoid failure because who wants to fail? And, you know, I think these are both just learning experiences, and they're just descriptions of something that's already happened. So what we try to do is experiment a lot. So we have this model we call trees, plants, and seeds. Trees, the big businesses that are mature, and the plants are fast growing businesses that we invest in. Seeds are the new ones. These are the ones that are really relevant here. The ones where we create small teams and we just experiment with users and try to create something that's really unique and different, powerful. And, We have between 5 and 20 new categories in development at a time, and they're run by sometimes just one person, often by entrepreneurs, but not always. And you know, they often don't make it out of the starting blocks, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that. We give the teams a bonus if they don't make it out, and we move them on to other things, and we try to make it not feel like a failure. It doesn't work because we're going to have a lot of those. It's by design. That's the way creativity happens, as Ed Catmull said.
I interviewed an ex-colleague of mine who I spent all my life working in branding and advertising, and one of my creative partners is now an inventor. And we were talking about failure and success, and he follows a German philosopher's view. And it's a thing called emergence, that everything is emerging. That what happened yesterday is a bit like your line in the sand sort of example from earlier, that we're all in this state of emergence. And when you actually embrace the principles of emergence, nothing is a failure, nothing is a success. You're just every day progressing on the pathway towards where you're meant to go, which I think is an interesting sort of philosophy to, it really does sort of start to ground you.
I love that. I really love that. I hadn't heard that.
Yeah, it's really good. I'll send you a link to his interview where he talks about it and the timestamp, because he delivers it so eloquently. And I've heard a lot of people watch that went, oh my goodness, that's made me rethink my life.
Well, I think it's a wonderful way to think. You know, some people say it's rationalization, but I get the question all the time, you know, what's, if you could go back to your 20, you know, when you're 19, you could do something, what would you do? And I always say, I just don't even know how to answer that.
Yeah.
I could not answer that. I maybe because I don't let myself answer, but I just don't believe in that. I believe in your concept of, or his concept of emergence.
Yeah. It's fascinating. You'd spend a lot of time with founders and startups as a leader of essentially a Fortune, believe it, Fortune 200 company?
Fortune something.
yeah, whatever. But I think that is quite unusual for someone to actually dedicate so much time to spend time with founders and startups. Presumably you have a really good reason for doing it, but it obviously helps you stay close. I think you've said close to the edge. But what lessons do you learn from these conversations, observations, and experiences?
Well, first, why did I do it? I did it because I moved out of Silicon Valley. And, if you don't live in Silicon Valley, especially when I was moving out here 10 years ago, all you hear is now this is like a startup mecca, so I wanted to get an understanding of what that scene is all about. So I immediately came out, went to see venture capital firms all over the place, and then started meeting with founders who would reach out to me. And I met with three a day to three a week. In the early days, it was always three a day. I would usually do it at breakfast. I had a room blocked off in a tiny little restaurant here that they basically gave me the room and said, you're here so much. We want you away from our other customers. So, you can have this room back here and people would just come. I'd just run, have meetings there, It was awesome. And I learned so much. One of the things I learned was the power of small teams. I was just blown away. We'd have some big team working inside Logitech my first year or two on some very difficult problem. And then I'd see, a 3-person team or a 4-person team come in and they've already either solved that problem or one that looked like it in 3 months with nothing but 3 or 4 people. And we had an army work out for a year. I was like, what is wrong with us? And then I realized it's not something wrong with us. It's just too many of us. We need to have fewer people working on this, and maybe more things work on. But the small teams are where the action is. And I really learned that from startups.
Mm-hmm. I suppose at that time when you joined Logitech, it was still the early days of the agile thinking movement. And the startups were obviously the first to embrace agile. So presumably that was a part of it in flattening the structures and creating more direct reports.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, interesting. You've had a fascinating journey of transformation professionally and personally. And through your public speaking and increasingly through your writings, you've shared a lot of your wisdom, cautionary words about success. We talked about the rejection of the word failure and then using learning experiences as the lens through which you look at it. You've also been very transparent about your growth as a leader. And it's interesting hearing you talk, and which again is quite rare in CEO circles, of being so transparent about your personal growth. What led you to be so authentic and transparent?
I think I have a hard time answering what led me to be that way. It's kind of like, why are you the way you are? I don't really know, but I do think, I do love the transparency that I feel like I could be. I don't think I was this transparent for much of my career. I think it's easy to be transparent. 10 years of track record as a CEO, it's pretty good. It would be much harder in your first year to be to talk openly about some of the things I do now. It obviously not only gives you confidence, but it gives you a safety net. So I also realize when I'm giving advice to founders and things that my advice is a little too rooted in who I am. Sometimes I need to listen a hell of a lot more and try that crazy to empathize better, because I think it's not as easy for somebody who's, 28 years old and it's their first startup to be humble. You sometimes need to be, being your chest and talk about how great you are. And there's nothing wrong with that. But if you watched me too much, think, oh, being humble is like a super good idea, for everybody. There's a time to be humble. There's a time to be proud. So I don't know. I think I will pivot your question a little bit and just talk for a second about how bad I was in the beginning in some areas. I was pretty good in some areas, but I was really bad, for example, in managing my board. I came in with a chair who I love, who felt the same way I did about boards at the time. Felt like they were kind of necessary and evil, and you just try to do the bare minimum you could with the board, and they were a governance body. You didn't really add a lot of value. And so when they challenged me, I was very defensive. And everything they said, I felt like fortunately, mortally wounded, you know, if they criticized something I was working on. It took me, you know, 4 or 5 years to finally, or maybe 6, to finally realize, oh my gosh, this is what a wasted opportunity. These are amazing people who know my company better than most people would. And I have an opportunity to use them, put things in front of them and get them. They do have a governance job to do, which is great. But I've got to, you know, get a hell of a lot more thick-skinned and listen. You know, I don't have to do everything they say, but I should want to hear everything they say. So it took me too long to get to that point, you know, and maybe other CEOs are better than I was. But I'm right now. So now I really do get it.
Mm. Just as you were talking about looking back, was there a moment in time over those 10 years when you became abundantly aware that the company needed to do more in the sustainability space and you were early to embrace the carbon labeling?
Well, I was always a big believer in environmental sustainability. Even when I joined the company, we were already doing a lot of great stuff. We were moving to renewable power. I think we were at 92% of our sources of power from all of our factories and offices around the world was renewable. So we were already well downstream. We had a great operations leader as a believer. I was a big believer. It was one of those principles designed I believed in. And again, it was a little bit like, probably a little bit like D&I. I thought we were really the good guys. And then as I read more and more about where the world's going and global warming became more and more obviously happening, then it became, you know, I had this sense of urgency welling up in me. And one of my head of operations, Prakash Arikundra, he's the COO now. He had the same feeling and we would talk about this. And at some point, I think the light clicked for both. I mean, the light just completely went on bright for both of us. There's no more time. It's now. You know, we can't sit around and talk about, well, how we wish things were going to be. We have to go make them that way and then try to influence other companies with that. So that was probably 2018, 2019, when we really felt this incredible sense of urgency. And we haven't looked back now. You know, we're committed to climate negative. We're carbon negative. We're carbon labeling everything. We're going to 360. We've got recycled plastic in 70% of our products and our biggest product lines. We're going to do that everywhere. So we're all over this now. It's super urgent. Mm-hmm.
When I sent the question, I did put in a piece about the Ingvar Kamprad, the founder of IKEA's wonderful little book, The Testament of a Furniture Dealer.
Amazing.
It's one of the most undiscovered little gems of wisdom that I think every business leader should. And when I heard you talk about humbleness, it made me think of him and that perspective.
You're the first person in a long time that's mentioned it to me. First time I saw it was 2010, I think, or 2009.
Yeah, it was about the same time I saw it, yeah.
It's just a magical book, and I would encourage anybody who's never seen it to try to get a copy. I'm sure you can find it online now.
Yeah, you can. I'm going to put it in the show notes as well. But that humbleness, is that something you encourage in your teams and your other direct reports, or is it something you just think is just unique to yourself, or is it something you would think is something that the company should embrace?
Well, I try not to encourage kind of the all shocks. It was not the, you know, kind of humility, which is the false humility of, you know, let's pretend we didn't do something good, you know, because it looked like we're humble. You know, what we do have a value we specifically call out, which is humility. We partner that with another value, which is hunger. And drive, you know, real hunger. So the reason, but when we talk about the humility, we don't talk about it as, you know, oh, you know, yeah, we're great, but we don't feel great. You know, we don't talk about that. We talk about it completely as a realization that we have a lot to learn. That's the key. It's about humility is based on the fact that you just don't know as much as you need to, and you have to keep striving for more understanding.
Because I heard you talk about your early years of discovering your love of leadership through sport and your competitiveness you mentioned through your siblings. Presumably those characteristics, that drives that hunger and that competitiveness and the desire to win and be a leader in sustainability, a leader in DE&I, social justice, mental health, all the things you've talked about. So in a way, I suppose it's healthy competition. Is that fair? Or...
Yeah, it's very, very fair. I did grow up with, you know, in a competitive environment, you know, and it wasn't like my brothers were, you know, trying to rush into the breakfast table every day, but sometimes, and we were in really valuing competition, and maybe not as much the competition as the training and the development to compete. So I grew to love the principles and the practice and the form and practicing the form and trying to be an expert at that. And then the competition was just really a measuring stick, like when you used to stand in the doorway with your mom and she said, okay, now you've grown to your 5'1", you know. It was just a measuring stick. That's all competition is. But the real value is it's the principles and the process and the honing your skills and learning new ones and trying a new trick, you know, that you've never tried before. That's what I love.
Again, very stoic. You've talked a lot about three levels of design, and I interviewed Tony Fadell's ghostwriter not long ago and about his book, Build. And I think you've talked about very few reach that third level of design, but I do think that Tony Fadell, with Nest, came close to that. And having read a lot of what you've written on LinkedIn and heard you talk, I have to ask the question, can we expect the Bracken Darrell book?
I don't know. You know, I don't know. I do like to write, but I like to read great writing. I don't know. Yeah, I really don't know. I'm not being coy. I just don't know. I think if I felt like I could write something that was going to have a big impact and really be meaningful or try to be meaningful, I would do it. And if I wouldn't do it. So I think there's plenty of great stuff out there from a lot of great people. So I don't think you need another one. But if I really feel like, you know what, there's something not being done out there and I feel like I could do it, I'll do it, you know, and see how it goes.
The funny thing with Tony's book, he just had an Excel chart and he just filled in the Excel or the Google Sheets with all the things that he thought about, just lines, and he handed it to Dina and said, here you go write something with that. So if you ever want to sort of meet a good ghostwriter, I'll put you in touch with Dina. She's fantastic.
I'd love to meet her. I don't think I would write a book that way. I'm an English major.
Well, there you go.
It's a little harder for me to hand off the writing part of writing, you know, but he's obviously, you know, Tony Fadell, you know, I've met, and I'm just blown away by the things that he's, I agree with your comments about Nest. I think, you know, stage 1-3 designer or level 1-3 designer, it's really hard to get to that third level. It's really hard to get anywhere close to the midpoint of the second level, the way I measure it. So being a kind of company where you really design inside and out in everything that you do, even for your employees, a person who walks into the reception area of your office, they should experience something. They should walk away with a little surprise. They should walk away with, if you're really good, they might even walk away a little inspired, you know. If you pull that off, which very few companies do that. I mean, maybe Disney did that at one point when they were smaller. Maybe they're doing it now. I don't know. I'm not Disney, but I'm pretty impressed with the results.
Yeah, it's hard to think of actually companies that can deliver that and that experience. Yeah.
But what do you need to strive for? I mean, isn't that just incredibly exciting? You think, gosh, you know, what if?
I know. As a leader, everyone faces moments of uncertainty. I interviewed Richard Branson when I was working back in the day in some branded content. And he said, the only difference between me and anyone else is just I have more problems to solve than everyone else, and I solve them faster. In a way, that's interesting because it makes you suddenly realize that you're just facing this never-ending conveyor belt of problems. You get over one, and then there's another one to overcome, or challenges or barriers. But you must encounter times where you're facing unsurmountable barriers. How do you confront that, those moments of that everyone feels of fragility and doubt?
There's only one insurmountable barrier so far that I'm aware of, and it's death. The others are manageable. As long as you don't give up, you know, I think you can always hope to find a way to solve problems. So, and I really believe that. And I love it when we encounter something in our business where we say, gosh, you know, there are only two models. There's this scaled model where everything's really big. There's this, you know, completely fragmented model where everything's really small and there's no in between. And it can't be in between because you've got to be laser low cost or super different. And I love when I hear those things because it makes me want to do something different. You know, I love to find a new way. And I think there's always a way, you know, to do something, try something and to experiment. And I just very rarely hit these real dark periods of, oh my gosh, I'm out. I would much rather just act on something and then correct it later than sit around and doubt myself and worry about it, you know, too much.
Mm-hmm. What are your natural gifts and talents or your superpower?
My natural gifts are superpower. You know, I always struggle with that question too. I don't know what they are. I mean, I've always been, pretty good at academic learning, you know, but I'm a pretty good athlete, but I'm never going to be a pro player or something. I was taller than everybody else when I was growing up. So I was a natural leader because people naturally looked up to me. And I was, since I had older brothers, we did a lot of sports. I was a good athlete, but you know, that faded as my height equivalized everybody else's. So I don't know what my superpowers are. I guess maybe my greatest superpower is my buoyancy. I am very hard to knock down. I don't stay down for long.
What do people compliment you for?
Well, they compliment me for things I deserve and a lot of things I don't. I get a lot of compliments for the turnaround at Logitech, the amazing performance, blah, blah, blah. You know, I always say, you know, you do realize we got 6,000 people and one of 6,000 ever, and the other 5,999 people actually do have jobs. I spend as much time on Logitech as I spend. So it's very much a team effort. I guess the things that compliment me on that I think probably more badly is, you know, I'm a very nice person. I'm pretty quick and I'm a decent communicator. And I really do care about people.
Conscious of your time, I'll get to the last couple of questions. My goal with the podcast, I started out as an experiment in serendipity, just interviewing a few people I knew, and then they recommended other people, and it's gone on from there. But now what I'm doing with it is being more intentional and trying to facilitate and encourage random collisions between the guests where diverse minds can come together to trigger innovative thinking. So my question to you is, are you open for me connecting you with other guests like Dina Levinsky, the ghostwriter for Tony, or anyone else that I think is interesting that could lead to interesting conversations and sparks of innovation?
I would be more than open to that. That's the kind of thing I absolutely love. I love almost everything. I love everybody. So I think I would really enjoy them.
Cool. Okay. Well, I'll look forward to building that. The reason I'm doing it is I believe there are too many think tanks and we need to build more what I'm calling action engines, people that are connected together, making progress. Because I don't think enough people are connected together. There's a lot of people around the world doing amazing things in everything from mental health to criminal justice reform, all sitting under the SDG banner, but in their own particular lane. And I think sometimes we need to start doing cross-fertilization of those minds and those passions and experiences. So we'll be doing that. Bracken, thank you very much for your time. I know you're busy man, changing the world, making a difference, changing people's lives, making for a better planet. And I really appreciate your honesty and appreciate the time you spent with me. So thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Been a pleasure.
Okay, thank you. Okay, that's all for now, folks. Now, here's my ask of you. Please follow this podcast on Apple or Spotify or whatever player you use. Also, please subscribe to our new Random Collisions newsletter. We really are working to build a global community of action takers, action engines of people that really care about the problems that need solving. Thank you very much, and see you next time.